Do you ever feel like you're constantly proving yourself at work, doing more, staying later, saying yes to everything just to be seen, respected, or promoted? What if the key to influence and success wasn't about working harder or chasing power, but building status? In today's episode, I sit down with Allison Frigel. She's the author of Likeable Badass, How Women Get the Success They Deserve, to talk about why status actually matters more than power and how motherhood changes the way women are perceived at work and the simple shifts you can make to be admired, respected, and valued without overworking yourself. You're going to walk away with a whole new lens on ambition. So are you ready? Let's get to it. Welcome to the Ambitious and Balanced Working Moms Podcast, your go-to resource for integrating your career ambitions with life as a mom. I'm distilling down thousands of coaching conversations I've had with working moms just like you, along with my own personal experience as a mom of two, and sharing the most effective tools and strategies to help you quickly feel calm, confident, and in control of your ambitious working mom life. You ready? Let's get to it. All right, working moms. I am delighted to have a guest on the podcast. Today, I have Allison Frigel, who's going to talk to us all about what it means to be a likable badass. She wrote a book on it. I'm just so excited to pick her brain around what it takes for us as women to continue forward with our ambitions and our career and our goals in the ways that we want and not feel really held back by motherhood. So excited to have her here today. Thanks for being here, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Would you just tell us a little bit about yourself so we get a sense of who you are and what you're bringing to this conversation?
Sure. So on the professional side, I am a professor, business school professor. My field is organizational psychology. I've been doing that for over 20 years. And within that space, I speak a lot on negotiation and influence. That's actually how I came to really work with women, because those were topics where women would feel like they had challenges at work. And through that, I started creating content to help elevate women in a variety of different ways. But I speak and write and teach to working professionals, often women, about how to use behavioral science to do what they do as efficiently and as effectively as possible. And then on the personal side, I am a mom. I have three kids. They are 10, 13, and 16. I live in Chicago, but my university affiliation is the University of North Carolina. So I joke that I went remote before it was cool back in 2015. So I have the added degree of difficulty of navigating and managing a job that has commuting and remote work and travel and all of those things.
All those things. I'm so delighted that you're here chatting with us today. So I just want to dig into this kind of conversation around status and power as sort of a, just as a launching point. We're going to see where we go from here. So, you know, you talk a lot about, you know, status being more important than power when it comes to influence. So I'm just curious a little bit more about what you mean by that and how important that is for women.
Yeah. So power is controlling resources that have value. Money's a resource. So if you control the budget at work, or you have personal wealth, whatever it is, if you have money, you have something that other people want, and often they'll be influenced by you. So power is a source of influence, but not just money, other forms of power, like the authority to promote, to give people a raise, to give people a good performance review or a bad one, to make decisions without having to ask people. These are all forms of resource control, and they often will lead to influence. I joke, so my oldest is 16. I say, when I hold the car keys, I hold a valued resource. And so he might be more likely to do what I want him to do if he wants the resource. So absolutely, when we have power, we can often influence people. And that's why power is something we all seek in our own ways. Status is similar in that it is also a source of influence. Status is how much we're respected and highly regarded by other people. So when we talk about a person being a high status person, we're saying people respect and value that person. That's also a source of influence, because if you respect someone, you're much more likely to do what they want. Or conversely, if you don't respect someone, you're highly unlikely to ever do anything that they want. So they both matter a great deal. Where status comes in as being primary is that respect is really foundational. So if we are not respected, it's very hard for us to ever get power. Without status, power is really hard to get because we don't want to give resources to people we don't respect, whether it's money or a promotion or the car keys, whatever it is. If we don't value the person, we're not going to give them more control. And so understanding and putting a spotlight on status, the way we've talked about power for women at work, we've been talking about pay equity and representation equity for a really long time because those are forms of power. If you're underpaid and you're underplaced, you don't have as much control as you deserve. And that's a problem we should solve. But the other idea of making sure that people are as respected as they should be is something that I wrote this book to shine a spotlight on it because we don't talk about it as much.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Generally speaking, we all kind of know men have a lot more power than women do. And they are more of the decision makers, particularly, I mean, on all sorts of fronts, but, you know, obviously traditionally in our careers as well. And so as women start to think about, you know, getting ahead and making bigger progress and closing leadership gaps and things like that, I would imagine focusing more on status actually plays a big part in that.
It absolutely does. So the way we've coached people and trained people to think about power, and negotiation is often a tool for trying to gain more power, but it could be used for status. You know, you should go and negotiate for more money. You should negotiate for a promotion. Those are important things to do and good skills to have. But it's also important to understand the toolkit or the science of having your audience really value you. And that audience will change and grow over time, but respect remains really foundational and important for people. And what I try to make it do for people is say, look, women don't get as much respect as men either. There's a science to that. So we have a power problem and we have a status problem, but to demystify it a bit, power feels a little easier because once you get the resources, you have them and you don't have to negotiate for them anymore.
Right.
With status, you have to continuously be essentially earning it because it exists in other people's minds. And it feels like this idea of a fine line between building your status and chasing validation, which is something we can talk about. They're not the same, but they both are about understanding how other people see you and perceive you. And with status, we're trying to affect how other people see us in a way that they recognize our contributions, because that ends up being a really important resource for us to do a whole lot of things, right? Have good relationships, be influential, get the power we deserve, all the things.
Yeah, yeah. And it's tricky because we actually don't actually get to control other people's narrative of ourselves ever, right? Like we're talking about influencing their narrative, but you never get to actually decide what their narrative is. It's never in that way. So that there is something interesting about what you're saying here in the sense it's complicated. And we as women, I think you're right, you use the word chasing. We tend to chase validation. It's almost like we need that validation in some way. And it can become a real slippery slope when we talk about wanting to advance our career if we're always trying to chase that, something that we ultimately can never control.
That's right. So we can influence it. I sometimes will use the analogy of investing in a stock market. So we might say making an investment into stocks to increase your wealth is a good thing to do. And when you invest in that way, you are trying to benefit your future self. But you might have a good day in the market or a bad day in the market. And when you have a good day, if you wake up and think I'm a better person because now my stock portfolio is up, that's essentially letting that portfolio validate you. If you wake up and the market is down and you think I'm a terrible person and I'm no good, then you're letting that portfolio validate you. But you don't want to do that, but you also don't want to stop investing to say you want to separate the two, which is there's a reason to make the investment. And I have to recognize that that investment is going to pay off in the long run, but not in every moment of every day. And as things go up and things go down, I shouldn't redefine how I see myself. That would seem foolish based on how I was doing the stock market. So I think about how other people see us as a similar kind of investment. We want to invest in how our audience views us and how they value us, because that's an investment in our future self. But sometimes our investments won't pay off. And when they don't pay off, what we're much more likely to do when we invest in a human is to say, oh, now I'm not a good person. If they don't value me, if that particular investment didn't yield anything, now I changed how I see myself. And you, most people won't do that with the stock market. They might be a little bit unhappy, but they won't think
of course,
worst person because the market is down.
How silly, stupid I am for, yeah, we don't use
exactly,
that.
Exactly, right? You wouldn't beat yourself up. You'd be a little bummed, but you wouldn't beat yourself up and say, like, I'm a terrible person. I shouldn't be investing in the market. Forget the market. So it's that kind of idea, which is investing in how people see us is valuable. And it's a resource that we can draw on to achieve things that are important to us. So we shouldn't abandon it. But we also can't get caught up with every ebb and flow of how that resource is doing, that we're completely reevaluating how we see ourselves. And that's the validation piece versus, no, it matters, right? I say to people, you can't get married or get into college or get a job if you can't impress another person. So impressing other people is necessary for us to achieve things that we decide are important to us to live a happy life. So it's not, it's an investment we need to make, but then recognizing that even if the investment isn't momentarily giving us exactly what we want, we're not redefining ourselves.
In those terms. It's almost like there's a fine line between when it goes from building status to chasing validation, right?
Exactly.
You kind of got to know what that line is so it doesn't, we don't cross into the unhealthy side of it and create a whole bunch of other problems because we need the recognition and the validation to validate ourselves as, you know, human beings and so forth. Right. So I really want to get to a place at some point that's probably as we towards the latter part of this conversation as we really talk about, well, what do you do? How do you do that? I actually want to dig in a little bit to what happens with status and power for that matter when we become moms, because so much research shows, you know, gaps get vastly larger when we become moms in the workplace on all sorts of fronts, from, you know, pay gaps to leadership gaps and all sorts of things that happen for women when they become moms. And then actually it's interestingly the opposite for men, right? And things actually increase for them. And so again, it just, this is statistically what happens to us as women. And so for those women that really want to maintain their status and maintain their power for that matter and continue forward, even building more of it, I'm curious what you have seen as you have started to think about how parenting starts to affect these kinds of things for us as women.
Sure. Okay. So here's the quick, how do you get status 101, which will help answer this question. So okay. I called my book Likeable Badass for a very specific reason beyond that it's catchy. And that is, it's a reference to how we decide how much we respect other people. So every day you encounter lots of people in person, online, and your brain is always updating. What do I think of those people? And while you're doing that, other people are encountering you and their brains are updating their thoughts about you. Well, those thoughts that we have about people, they're not random. We're always trying to figure out the same two things about people. The first thing we want to figure out about people is, are they what we call other-oriented? Do they care about people other than themselves? And that's valued. We don't want selfish, difficult people. We want generous, helpful people. If I engage with you, it'll be enjoyable. You'll try to help me. That's what we want. So that's being other-oriented. In psychology, we often talk about it as a person's warmth. And it's a host of characteristics. On the cover of the book, I call it likable. But again, it's a constellation of things. It's not one thing. And then the other thing we try to figure out is, can I rely on you? So it's good that you care about me and your intentions are good, but can I trust you? If I put anything in your hands, will it be executed well? So that's going to be our results orientation. So we can deliver results. We're capable. We're competent. We're organized. We're persistent. In psychology, we often talk about it as our assertiveness. We can control our environment. And on the cover, I call it badass. But the idea is, when you're other oriented and results oriented, you have the winning combination. You care about people and people can rely on you. And when people believe both of those things about you, that's when respect is guaranteed to follow. Sometimes you can get respect just being one or the other, but the surefire way to do it is have people think that you're both. So where motherhood comes in is that we draw judgments on these dimensions about all kinds, based on all kinds of things. Gender is a characteristic that we'll use, but being a mother specifically, what do we see? The motherhood penalty is, related to these dimensions, is that women who are mothers are seen to be sometimes warmer because it's nurturing and maternal, but they're seen as less results-oriented, less competent, less capable, less driven, less ambitious, all of those things. So you take a hit on the other dimension. So that's something to be aware of. And it's one of the reasons that a lot of people do things like hide pregnancies, don't talk about kids, all those things, because they have some awareness essentially a lay psychologist, that if I talk about this, you will not see me as this capable and competent. And that's not true.
Yeah.
There's not one way to handle it.
Just to be clear, we know that to be factual on some level. Like, we do actually have cultural views of women as being less reliable. I mean, that's not like, we're not just making that up, right? Like, that is what we seem to think, right? I remember my own experience in my first pregnancy at work, and they ran a poll before I even, this is terrible and nobody should ever do this. And I didn't realize it at the time. And now I think back to it. I'm like, who does that? That's terrible. But they ran a poll on how likely I was to like come back and be as dedicated to my job. And, yeah. You know, and they joked about it with me later. And I thought, I thought it was funny. There I was, I came back to work and all the things. But now I look at it, I'm like, that is, there's so much judgment involved in that, right? Like, you should never judge a woman based on that. But anyway,
that's the motherhood penalty gone awry, right?
Yes.
And exactly. So that's what happens. Now, at the same time, it's important to recognize these things, but here's the really good news, because it's not just being a mother. Gender in general affects status, which is why I chose to write this book for women. But so does a host of other characteristics that we don't control: race, sexual orientation, accent, appearance. Yeah. There's lots of stuff that is outside of our control that people draw conclusions about who we are as people. That's the bad news. The good news is, from psychology, is what we see is that how a person shows up ends up having a bigger effect on how they're perceived than any of those uncontrollable things. Hmm. But so when we show up in particular ways, we can overcome these initial biases that people have, but it does mean that we have to play smart, and we don't want to unintentionally play into any of those narratives. Because if we do something unintentionally that makes them louder, we validate them. Mm-hmm. And so like me personally, for example, I'm a talk about my kids kind of person, because that feels authentic and natural to me. They're like, the fact that I have kids named after famous Chicago athletes, like in my bio, it's on my social media. I don't show pictures of my kids on social, but like, they're out there. But I also, and I think it's also, it does build that warmth, because it's a common point of similarity with other people, and similarity builds warmth. And so you can be building on one dimension. And the key here is, I always say to people, add, don't subtract. Be whoever you are, but recognize that you're going to have some things going for you that are going to make you maybe stronger on one dimension than the other. So subtracting would be things like feeling like I can't talk about my family, or I have to lie and say where I'm going at 5 o'clock and things like that. And that stuff feels like you're living a lie. You're not being your authentic self. And it leads to resentment, burnout, all the things.
Yeah.
Versus to be who you are and think, there are going to be human brains that are not out to get me, but those human brains are wired to basically judge me as less capable. Okay, I can fix that because I am highly capable. I just need to think about what signals do I need to start sending out into the world so that those brains read very capable, very capable, very capable. And once you start to think about it, you can find things to do that aren't very hard, that are very authentic, and that could send the signals that you want to send, recognizing where their starting point might be.
I mean, give us a few examples of those types of signals. I love that. I got a great visual on it. And so I was like, tell me more.
One is to just, when we talk about self-promotion, which people don't, no one likes that term. I don't either, even though I do research on it, is you got to talk about yourself in powerful ways, right? How many people go do great things and then never speak of them to anybody and then think nobody thinks I'm very capable? And I would say, I mean, I was talking to a woman, for example, I met at an open event, and it was a book talk, and she came to it and she said, I just always thought my work should speak for itself. And I said, okay, let me use me as an example with you. I said, how could your work ever speak for itself with me? Because we're just meeting right now and we don't work together. So if I can't leave this conversation knowing anything about you, unless you tell me, like, that's your only choice right now is to tell me. Yeah. And so even when you work with people, they do not have full visibility into you all day, every day. They have mostly no idea.
And we're super self-absorbed. So we barely recognize what other people are doing. That's just our human construct.
100%. One of my favorite studies on that in psychology was, bad, this will be a sign of the times it was done, was they made undergraduate students go in and meet a fellow undergraduate student wearing a Barry Manilow t-shirt, which was at the time the most uncool thing they could think of. And the whole thing was to predict how many students would remember what the other person was wearing. And the person with the Barry Manilow shirt said, 100% of the people are going to remember that I'm wearing a Barry Manilow t-shirt as a college student.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the numbers were. It was like 50%. Most people are not paying attention. So the idea of, we have to tell our own stories. So many people aren't telling their own story, and then they're really upset that people don't see them as capable. And I would say, is there some initial bias there? Absolutely. But are you doing anything to put that story out there in a way that counters that bias and says to that brain, you've got it wrong? You're not. But as soon as you start telling your story, so talking about yourself in ways that, you know, feel authentic, but also showcase what you can do is useful. The other thing that is useful is to add value to people's lives. The surest way to show up as caring and capable is use your talents to make someone else's life better. Then they can't deny your capability. Yeah. But we can't burn ourselves out doing it. So that's the other challenge with women is that we ask women to do all the non-promotable work, all the office housework, and we scurry around doing it because we think it's going to get us points for either being warm or capable. And we certainly, and then we find out maybe it gets us neither. You have to be thoughtful in easy things that don't take a lot of time that also have that benefit of showing you as capable. So my favorite example is making introductions. So you meet a new person, or even if it's someone you've worked with for a while, and you think, what does that person care about? And who do I know in my network that they don't know that could be mutually beneficial to introduce them? Yeah. The beauty I like of many of us are connectors. The beauty I like of making an introduction is one, it's very fast and you get out of the way. So it's a super efficient way to add value because you're not sitting there for hours and hours doing someone else's work. You're just like, meet this person, good luck. And all, they're doing the work, you're gone. But the other thing is it distinguishes you as someone of value. Oh, wait, you know, you're really connected. You know people I don't know. It's a simple way. It's not the only way, but it's a simple way to say, I did something where I have a unique attribute that you don't, in this case, a person I know, and I've given that to you for your benefit. And that's really going to be our surefire way to hit on both of those dimensions, right? I care about you because it didn't help me, it helped you. And I showcase something that I'm good at. So I always tell people to start with what they love and what they feel like they're good at, even if it sits outside your job description, because you can distinguish yourself as a person who is very helpful and very capable simply by starting with what you love. So an example I give, I heard of a guy tell me that he just reads a lot. He reads a lot of nonfiction and he naturally takes notes when he reads nonfiction because that's how he just retains and summarizes what he wants to do. So he's just doing that for himself. It has nothing to do with his job. It's how he spends his free time. But then he realized that a lot of his colleagues also like to be educated, read nonfiction, but they often complain they didn't have time or they weren't as consistent as he was. And they certainly didn't take notes. And so he just started taking his typed up notes and like putting a little header on them and sending them to people when they expressed interest. And it turned into a big distribution list that he had where he was sending this out. And now everyone is like, what are you going to read next? Like, were you reading some? He became interested. And everyone wanted to talk to him. And he said, I was doing nothing other than what I was already doing, except I just hit send on that message. And so that's where I encourage people is if you can find those things, then that way you can really live with ease and joy and authenticity of I'm just doing what I'm doing. But my strategy piece is taking that one extra step to make that thing I'm already doing beneficial to another human being. I think, you know, when I coach people on these things, I have them tell me their stories. I practice doing this. I'm almost always able to like find something that they already love and do that they can turn into an easy benefit for other people.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. You know, another one that was coming to mind too, that as you were talking about it, another way to kind of add value that feels really simple is I think a lot of us tend to, I speak for myself for sure, it like check out in meetings or conversations when it doesn't relate to me. Right? Where it's like, it's not my time to talk, or we're not talking about my department, or we're not talking about, you know, something that interests me, you know, or doesn't, it's like, it's my time to wait, you know? And so I'll do something else, or my mind will wander. I'll quietly start writing about something else versus like, I'm already sitting here in this meeting. Like I might as well add value. What if I actually listened and then offered my opinion into that, or like gave a suggestion? I mean, I'm already trapped here as it is. So taking time in meetings like that can be a really simple, easy way where you're already spending your time there anyway, where you get to just display value that you already have to other people, right?
Absolutely. And the other two things you can do in those meetings, one is pay attention to the status dynamics in the room and you'll see some people are talked over. Some people don't get to finish their ideas. Some people's ideas get, you know, just ignored until they're repeated by a more high status person. And you can amplify those things. You can say, let's go back to what that person was saying. It's really easy when it's not your fight to be able to build those relationships and add value to people that way. To say, hey, you stood up for me. And people's brains will remember. And then the next time in the meeting, they might be more likely to speak up to you. And so thinking about investing in relationships in that reciprocity of what would I want someone to do for me in that situation. That's one thing we can do. And I think the other thing is sometimes people say to me, like, I've gotten the reputation of being kind of aggressive when I'm trying to push ideas through.
Yeah.
And I'd say, well, if people only see you get kind of fired up when it's your idea, how's it going to look? Because you just sit there. And then when it's yours, you're really passionate about it. But if you're passionate about other people's ideas too, to your point of, I think this is totally the way to go, then it doesn't seem as self-interested when you're doing it for yourself. But if you're only speaking up when you're the beneficiary, you will look more self-interested because you're acting more self-interested.
Yeah, yeah. I was just having a conversation with a client actually who is in a very male-dominated industry and struggles. She also is not American, and there's a dialect issue, right? An accent issue and all these things that make it more challenging in her job place. And she is often told that she's too like abrasive, right? And she feels like she has to speak up a lot and she is spoken over a lot and she does not have people around her that are trying to elevate her and stand up for her and so forth. And so she struggles with both status and power in these moments and trying to figure out, you know, how to overcome some of these, you know, barriers of from immigrant to woman to mom to, you know, color of skin to accent to all the things that are kind of not already biases and not in her favor. I'm curious what you would say to her.
Yeah. So I'll talk to her and then I'll talk to like people who are not yet in that situation, but don't want to be. So at this point, you're already in a hole. You're saying people are not viewing me the way I want them to. And now I need to change people's minds. Okay. You just need to be realistic. That's a harder task. You've had people that you have not been that keen on and you've warmed to them. It doesn't happen overnight. So if someone wants to change a person's mind, they have to be really consistent. So it's going to take longer than you think. Most people give up too early. But the other thing that will speed it up is you need to use your allies to speak on your behalf. If you're trying to do it solely on your own, you will have a hard time. But if there are people who can see your true value, and they are themselves high status and respected in those networks to say, I need your help. For whatever reason, maybe it's my fault, maybe it's not. These people do not see the value that I can bring. And I think you need to tell that story that's not just woe is me, I deserve it. But more, if they don't see my value, that limits how much I can contribute and that hurts all of us. Mm-hmm. And so you always have to spin that story back to the other people, not just me, me, me. And say, I need your help. And let me be specific about what I need. Maybe it's the next time if you're in a meeting and if you could amplify this idea so that they don't just hear it from me, or you could talk about the great work that I'm doing. And if people believe that that is true, it's not a very big ask. And so you'll almost, get a yes.
Yeah.
That's what I would tell people is think about the network map and who your allies are that are highly respected by the people you're trying to change their minds and start using them as intermediaries. What I would say to everybody listening who's thinking, oh goodness, I'm glad I'm not in that situation, I would say, don't get in that situation. And the easiest way to is just from the beginning of a relationship, if you start to build your status as broadly as possible long before you need it, you can avoid, maybe not all of these things, because to your point, we don't control other people, but you can avoid a lot of them by starting to think at the very beginning of a relationship, how might people see me and how could I show up in a way that would signal as often as possible to as many people as possible, I really care and I know what I'm doing. And the challenge for most people is they do not think about this until something like this happens with your client. They realize they have a problem and now they don't like it. They shouldn't.
Yeah.
And now they want to change it. But I always think, what were they doing 6 months, a year ago, a few years ago, however long this has been going on, to try to shape their audience's mind before their audience had spent any time thinking about them? When you meet someone for the first time, even if they're carrying some implicit bias with them, it just doesn't take much to overcome it. Oh, like, you're pretty interesting. Like, you're great. Thanks for helping me. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. But the longer you've spent undervaluing someone, the harder it is. Yeah. And that, I think, is one of the things I really like to coach people on is when you don't need anything from anybody, when you're new in a relationship, building your status is kind of fun. It feels joyous. Like, I can help you out. Doesn't really matter if you help me out in return, I don't need anything. But those little things that you can do add up, and what you end up having over time is a bigger and bigger, bigger base of people who really see your value, who talk about it to others, and it starts to magnify and amplify.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned earlier and just touch on it a little bit, which was how we as women, and I think particularly we ramp this up, you know, after we have kids, because again, we're trying to like make, we feel like we're making up, right? We have to make up for not being as reliable that in all these things, but we overcompensate for that by saying yes to too many things, doing the admin work, you know, doing kind of filling our schedule with things that aren't necessarily our priorities. We start to deplay being a mom. You know, we don't want to talk about that. So we don't talk about needing to leave at 5 o'clock to go get our kids and things like that. And we stop showing up authentically. And I think it's pretty common experience for us as women, particularly as we kind of rise up in our careers and look to be further. We have to feel like we have to look less and less like a mom and more and more like, you know, a male colleague on some level. And I'm curious what some of your thoughts are on how we start to shift that for ourselves and maybe a reframe that would be helpful to us.
Yeah, I would suggest that there's a gendered component to this as well, but I'll take my husband and other men that I talk to who definitely feel these types of pressures a lot. Mm-hmm. Of anytime you feel like you are doing something different than the work all the time, you do feel highly visible. And I think about this, my husband thinks about this. I mean, he's senior enough in his role right now that he no longer has to care as much, but like he occurred to him at some point, like very, he was like, I'm the only guy, and it's all guys in his finance firm, of a certain level. I'm the only guy with a spouse that has a career. I'm the only guy who says no, that I can't go to things because you're out of town and someone needs to be home. Mm-hmm. It didn't bother him, but it occurred to him. So yeah. What I would say is the pressures are actually more shared. And I was like, I never thought about that for one second. Like I was always just thought like it was hard on me. Like never mind the idea that your male colleagues certainly expect that you're going to be there all the time if you're another man, right?
Yeah,
So I think there's a lot of this that people feel. And I say that because example I'm going to tell is from another man, a general in the Air Force. And I have done traditionally a lot of senior leader education in the Air Force and the Army, mostly men at that level. But there's definitely a work all the time. Like the military is your life. And a lot of guys who were saying like, they never see their families, they have no balance. And this general spoke up and he basically said, unless I was at war, I was home with my kids at dinner at 6 o'clock every single night. And I still became a general. And I don't think it's because I was just so incredibly talented. He said, I basically just decided it was important. I started acting like it was important. Didn't like make a huge deal one way or the other, but I didn't lie about it. I just went and said like six, you know, he's like, I'd get back on at night if I had to, but like 6 to 8, no, I'd start leaving every time. And he's like, basically what happened was I trained people that no one ever came looking for me at 5:45 because they knew I wasn't going to talk to them. And I wasn't there at any point, whether I was junior, senior. And he said, and I did it without repercussions. So I think one of the things that we have to think about is what's important to us. And if something's important, to say, I'm going to protect it. And to recognize that when things don't get protected, sometimes it's because we've trained people that that's not important. And so when you respond to emails at all hours of the day or do things like that, I always say to people, are you doing it because you're 100% sure it's expected? Like, have you ever tried not doing it and saw what kind of negative consequence you got? Or have you simply trained people that that's how you work and then they're interacting with you more and more and more in that regard? Yeah. So I think about what's important. And then here's where I think negotiation skills come in, is being a first mover. So if you're a second mover is like, you kind of wait to see what the other person wants of you and then feel like you have to say yes. Yeah. Like, hey, how about a 7 a.m. meeting? You're like, well, that's not very convenient. Like now what am I going to do? But now I got to say yes. I'm like, try not to put yourself in that situation. The more you can get out in front of the thing that matters, whether it's your schedule, whatever it is, and say, hey, we need to talk about this. Here are 3 times that work for me. They all fall between the hours of 10 and 2. I don't need to say anything other than that. If none of them work, let me know. We'll find an alternative. And when you do things like that, where you give people a few choices that are bounded within things that work for you, they often just pick between the set. And so if they really can't do it, they'll push back. Most of the time, they're like, yeah, one of these works. So that's something I think we underutilize as human beings, but particularly can be useful for women, is be the first mover. If there's something you want, don't sit back and like hope that everyone will protect it for you. Decide it's important and then start to organize what you're doing. Like, block the hour on your calendar so no one can get to it. You can always take it off. You can start to do things like that. Now, all that said, I mean, I'm 16 years into the whole parenting thing. I'm reevaluating. I'm like changing my system on an almost daily basis. Like, nothing works forever and nothing works perfectly. And it also feels a little bit chaotic, but the difference I can see between women who feel like it's chaos, but it's good chaos and I can kind of manage it. And the women who feel like this is driving me to the ground. I don't know how many more days I can go on. You know, nobody feels like they have it all together, but I think that the more you can start to recognize what your boundaries are and experiment with, is the idea that you will be punished for creating this boundary a story that only exists in your head? And it might not be. I mean, it might be a real punishment or a real boundary, but I think a lot of people haven't really explored that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I coach on it all the time. I talk to people all the time. You have to start with the priorities and the non-negotiables in your life, right? It has to start there. And it's not anybody else's job but your own to protect it. And if you are in a workplace or an environment of some kind that doesn't make that easy for you, you know, you always have the option to leave it on some level, right? We always have choice involved in all of these things, as difficult as that might be. But we have to take, I'm hearing in a lot of this conversation is, sure, we might be starting at a deficit or a bias in some way or things like this. And yet we can take a lot of ownership still over the way we are viewed, over our status, over our power, over our trajectory, over our priorities, right? We can be strategic in the ways that we show up and be effective with our time, our energy, our positioning, our influence, and all the things that are going to be big at the end of the day.
Yeah. I also think that, you know, we also equally at the same time hold a bunch of narratives about how we're supposed to be as parents that create guilt about things that we might not actually feel guilty about. So I think about where I get asked a lot, I travel a lot for work. And people are like, oh, that must be really hard. I'm like, it's hard in some ways, but you know what? It's actually easier in a lot of other ways. Guess what I get to do when I travel? Only get myself dressed in the morning. I don't have to like rush out in heels doing any school drop-offs, worrying about bedding, getting to a meeting on time. Guess what I get to do when I get back from whatever it is I'm doing out of town? Be in a hotel room by myself, work, sleep, work out, et cetera. So, but a lot of it I had to contend with was the fact that I was feeling like I was supposed to be doing a certain set of things. And then I had to release myself from that too, which was, it's one thing to be pressured to be at work a lot by your colleagues and feel like that's not what you want to do. But it's another thing to be pressured to feel like you have to be at home a certain amount or do it in a certain way that creates a different set of pressures where you're creating boundaries that you actually for yourself don't need to create. You're only doing it because you're buying into the idea that that's somehow what a good mom is supposed to do. Like a good mom is supposed to pick her kids up from school or have dinner with them every night or this or that. When you might be like, you know what? Like I might be perfectly fine working through dinner. It suits me. It doesn't bother me, but it's a narrative. So I think once we get really aware of those things, and I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book on that regard is the idea of status as a resource to support your life. And decisions like this related to what boundaries, what do I do like as a mom, as a professional, all these dilemmas that we have in the present are much easier to resolve if we have a good idea of what we're going for. And what we're going for is a future state of ourselves 5 years from now, at the end of our career, whatever it is. And I have some exercises that I walk people through to get really clear on what do you want to achieve in certain amounts of time and what do you want to be known for? How do you want people to describe you? And once you get clear on those things, it starts to make a lot of these dilemmas in the present a lot easier. So
yeah,
one thing for me that I realized that helped a lot was recognizing as a parent that having strong relationships with my adult children was a really important like goal for me, but that having like strong relationships with my toddler children was not particularly important unless I thought it was going to affect like how they would feel about me as adults. So I was the kind of person who felt fine to miss like the first step or the first word or things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm less fine to miss things now that they're older. But also when I made the decision to move to Chicago and go remote from my job, which was very unusual at the time, that is a decision that I think a lot of people struggle with even, you know, still. Do I do that? Do I prioritize family over kids? I was pretty young at the time. I wasn't even 40 when I did that, but it was easy for me. And the reason it was easy was because I had this real clarity of what was a longer term goal. And I thought, if I go to Chicago, it is currently the third biggest city in the world. And I'm sorry, in the country. And I have a greater chance that my adult children will be able to be employed and live near me if I live in Chicago. So I was like, they may not, that's their life.
Yeah, yeah.
But at least there's a chance. And so it made a hard decision really easy because I had this future thing and I thought, hey, this will actually support this future thing that I really want. So what I would encourage everybody is if you look out past today and think about in whatever version of the future, 1, 3, 5, 10 years, what you want and use that to guide today's decisions. Like if I do this today, it'll make it more likely or less likely. Mm-hmm. I'll have those things that I want in the future. A lot of the struggles that women have of should I, shouldn't I, start to feel a little bit easier because they're guided by something.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, the concept I usually talk about is like laddering up to a vision, right? We got to make our decisions today that ladder up to a vision.
Exactly.
So, definitely.
Exactly.
I love that. So good. Oh, Allison, I feel like we could just talk about this forever. Thank you so much for being here and for coming on this podcast and talking to us about this. I think it's really helpful for women to have another frame to think about this because we, as women, don't have to choose between our career and being a good mom. We can have both, right? That's what this podcast is all about. This community is all about. So Allison, if people want to learn more about what you do or read your book, where do they go?
I think the easiest thing for people to do is go to my website, which is just my name, allisonforgale.com. And on there, there's all the media and podcasts and things I've ever done. There's my book. There's my newsletter, which is called The Upper Hand. That's free. You can connect to my socials there, all the things. So that is a good place for people to go.
I love it. And of course, that will be in the show notes as well if you want to check that out. So all right, working moms, thank you so much for being with us in this episode this week. And until next time, let's get to it. If you wake up most days spinning with 100 different priorities vying for your attention, then the daily kickstart is exactly what you need. It's a simple 6-step process that helps you get your thoughts out of your head, reset your mindset, and refocus on what actually matters. It's designed to help shift you out of overwhelm and into calm, confident action before the chaos hits. This daily practice is the same tool I offer to all my clients, and it's going to show you exactly how to lead your day instead of react to it. It takes just 10 minutes a day, and the impact will ripple through everything: your mood, your energy, your presence with your kids, and how you lead at work. My clients indicate time and time again that this tool was the one that made the biggest difference for them, and I'm offering it to you totally free. You can download it by going to www.ambitiousandbalanced.com/daily-kickstart. And of course, I'll have that for you in the show notes as well. All right, working moms, let's get to it.